Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Barbara Marshman. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, author of Prescription for the Future, the 12 Transformational Practices of Highly Effective Medical Organizations. Dr. Emanuel is the Vice Provost of Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and was the founding chair of the Department of Bioethics at the National Institutes of Health. He also served as special advisor for health policy in the Obama administration and helped craft the Affordable Care Act. I suspect that's why many of you are here. Dr. Emanuel is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the chair of the Meta-Council on the Future of Healthcare Committee for the World Economic Forum, and was elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science, the Association of American Physicians, and the Royal College of Medicine. He received his master's in science from Oxford University, his MD from Harvard Medical School, and PhD from Harvard University. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Zeke Emanuel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's great to have you here. So let me just start for our audience in the room. How many of you have read the book, or at least part of the book? Anyone? Oh, we do have some. Good. But not enough that we shouldn't share some information about the book.
Yeah.
Before we came out here, we were talking, and Dr. Emanuel said that when he started this project, he had some ideas that he knew he wanted to write about, and then he discovered a lot of other ideas that belonged in the list. Want to talk about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, the goal of the project was to go around the country and see who was doing great medicine, defined as really, really high quality and consistently high quality medicine at a low cost. So getting to the sweet spot that we all need the American healthcare system to go to. And I had some ideas as to what those organizations were doing. I thought some of them would be standardizing care. I don't know if you mentioned, I'm an oncologist, and one of the things we think delivers high quality care in cancer is everyone follows a protocol. And so I thought standardization would be one thing. And then performance feedback, I'd heard of a lot of places that had given their doctors information about how they were doing and doing it in a particular way. And then the one that I'd heard the most about would be chronic care coordination and working with patients who had diabetes or congestive heart failure and really proactively reaching out to them, because I visited some places that did a really great job there. And then you go around to a bunch of different places and you find out they're doing a whole lot of other things, and there were like 9 different practices that I had no idea. But in this kind of research, what ends up happening is you go to one place, they tell you about the 2 or 3 things they're doing. You go to another place, they tell you about the 2 or 3 things you're doing. And you, by the time you're at your 3rd or 4th one, it's like a rerun. You know, they're describing it slightly different language, but everyone's really doing the practices similarly. So in addition to those, some people are, not everyone, but many places are doing some great innovative things around scheduling patients. Some places are doing great innovative things. I mean, and probably the most surprising to me is rooming. So taking a patient from the waiting room back into the exam room, you know, worthless 2 minutes, right? You would think, how could that possibly be important to transformation? And then you go to places that have really focused in on that and used it to really deliver high-quality care to people. It's like, wow, that's amazing. And I would say the other interesting thing for me, totally unexpected, is I thought, you know, big organizations, they have the know-how, they have the money, they have a talent, they can really concentrate, they can sometimes hire consultants. But we found a lot of transformational practices at small groups, 9 groups of oncologists, 15 primary care doctors out in Hawaii, and it's all across the country. And I'll say one other thing that totally surprised me is even the best places in the country, places that are really doing a phenomenal, phenomenal job and have been doing it for 20, 30 years, still weren't doing all 12. And that gave me sort of heart that even at the tippy top of consistency in American healthcare, we can improve.
About the scheduling, I was fascinated as I read the book. The move would be toward allowing real-time scheduling, making sure that when patients call, they can get to see a doctor right away, they can get to see a specialist right away. Everything that's important happens when it should happen. And I thought, man, I'd like to organize my life that way. I mean, how do you get from where we are now, where you might have to wait a week to see your primary care physician, to that kind of scheduling?
So the whole focus on scheduling occurred when I was trying to make an appointment with my primary care doc. And, you know, I'm fancy myself. I got a lot of titles at Penn, and, you know, people know who I am. And so and we have this brand new thing where you can actually email your doctor. Wow, so 21st century. So I emailed and said, you know, I have this problem and, you know, maybe I should come in. It's been a year and we should check it out. And a day later, his nurse says to me, oh, yeah, why don't we see you on whatever it was, I think, May 23rd or something, 7 weeks from when I emailed him. And I'm like, you know, is this the way you... Bigwigs get treated here. thank God I'm not, you know, just a random Joe. And then he got all chagrined when he heard about this, and so he emailed me quickly back. He says, you know, just figure out, I'll try to double book you in, you know. And so I sent him back some dates, and we definitely got better. 3.5 week wait. And I was like, this is insane. This is not... So you go to places and you talk to them about the scheduling, and there are two things that, again, transform places emphasize. The first one is what you were referring to, open access scheduling. That what they do at the start of the day, the doctors, and lots of other healthcare providers, nurse practitioners, physician assistants in the office, between 20 and 50% of their appointment slots are empty for people who either have an urgent problem or people who find that they have time off and want to get something that they've been waiting to get done. And typically they save even more time after weekends or after holidays because there's almost invariably a rush. I like to tell the story that I'm a little Jewish kid. And when I was an intern and resident, I said, you know, I'm happy to work Christmas. You know, it's holidays, doesn't mean anything to me. And, you know, a lot of you, you know, it's an important family holiday. And what I didn't realize until I did my first one is like, wow, this is fantastic. Nothing happens on Christmas Day, right? The hospital is dead. I used to see two movies. My kids would come into the hospital. We'd play around. I mean, you know, if you got called to a bedside once in the 24-hour period, it's like, you know. But the next day, like all hell broke loose. You know, everyone was coming in. The emergency rooms backed up. So if you do open access scheduling, they say, you know, the day after Thanksgiving, make sure you have a lot of empty time. Or the day after Christmas, make sure you have a lot of empty time. And what this permits places that do it is instead of sending a patient who has something that develops to the emergency room where a doctor really doesn't know, you're trading calls and or having to double book a patient like my doctor wanted to do with me where everyone's dissatisfied, some patient's waiting too long, I'm sitting there waiting till the doctor's, you know, finished early with some patient, he's feel like he harried all. You have time to address serious problems. You can forestall emergency room visits. You can address serious problems. And if one slot's not filled, you can spend more time with the patients who you need to. Doctors resist this mightily. And I sort of ran this by my father, who was a pediatrician for many, many years. He says, yeah, but I would be losing money. You know, there are all these empty slots. It turns out there are never all these empty slots. Right. And then what you don't figure as a practicing doctor, which all the data shows is, look, if you called your doctor's office and scheduled at 10 a.m., and the doc said, doctor's receptionist said, come in at 1, the chance that you're not coming in at 1, zero, right? On the other hand, if 7 weeks from now I'm supposed to see the doctor, who knows what's going to come up? I might have a speech. I might have to be at the Commonwealth Club in California and, you know, have to rearrange. So Turns out no-shows, which are a bane of all doctors, I mean, you know, no-shows can be as high as 40% for many practices, drop down to, you know, below 5% when you do this. So it's a huge benefit. And then places that go even further, they just take the scheduling away from the doctor's office altogether and they put it at a call center because that allows actually other ways. If the doc can't see you, you can go to a affiliated physician. There's a lot of ways of actually structuring, you know, if you need multiple things, structuring it much more efficiently when it's not controlled just by one doctor, if you're sort of in a larger multi-group specialty. Anyway, every place that has most places that have transformed, this is one of the top items. There are still some great places that haven't gone to open access scheduling. Yeah. And one of the reasons the CEO of this one particular place talked to me, he says, well, you know, I need to get my docs to do that because they're resistant like everyone else.
Well, part of what you talk about is needing to include the doctors in these transformations.
Yes. Doctors, willy-nilly, and I know a lot of people, I often get nurses who come up to me and sort of badger me about this. Willy-nilly, they're the leaders of the ship. Yes, they should run the team well, but if they're not on board, it ain't going to succeed. If they're on board, you still have lots of other constituents, the nurses and the pharmacists and others to bring on board. But if the doctors have to be on board, and there are many, many things which we've tried in the past to sort of impose on physicians, and if you don't win their support or if there's not a champion who also is a physician, most of these things will not succeed. Now, the person convincing the doctor doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor. I've been to many places where very charismatic and competent non-physician leaders happen. Mm-hmm. But you know, you do need to win the doctors over. Typically, it's giving them some authority over this area, asking their advice, increasing their pay, or showing that the activity is going to increase their pay, or just make their lives easier, take away some administrative burden, et cetera. Not everything is money. A large, large amount of what doctors are complaining about these days is hassle factor. And if you can reduce that hassle factor in a variety of ways, they'll be thankful, even if it doesn't increase their pay. It'll just increase the smoothness of the day.
Make life better for them,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned that for most organizations to begin a serious transformation, you need a crisis. Not for all, but
yeah.
but it's often. So how does that, what does a crisis look like?
We're going out of business.
That would do
for
it.
For many of these organizations, there were financial losses, there was mismanagement, bad organization, and they really were going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. Unless something substantial was done. And let me just give you two examples of larger organizations. So one of the organizations I visited was Dean Clinic out in Madison, Wisconsin. And half of the Dean Clinic is sort of Kaiser-like, where they both take insurance and provide the care, and half of it is they take other people's insurance and provide the care. And let us just say totally mismanaged. They had two boards of directors, one for the doc side, one for the insurance side. They didn't work together. The incentive structures were not aligned. No one knew who really had authority over how things were run in the clinic. There was a sense that people who complained the most, you know, things got done for them, but not for the whole. And they, 2 years in a row, lost a substantial amount of money. And they had a leader who saw the problem. They merged the boards. Four of the five top people were gone within a year. And the most important leader there turned out not to be a physician. It was a woman leader who was not the CEO either and drove the change. The chairman of the board became the chief medical officer. And they really got everyone together about redesigning what they were doing. As a matter of fact, what was really interesting about them is not only did they get the medical staff and the nursing staff and everyone else who was working there, they actually, when they were designing one of their new facilities, is they put on the board a couple of their patients and told me about marked changes. having a glass store right in the clinic, a store for glasses and things like that that they wouldn't have done otherwise. And a second example is Kaiser Permanente, Mid-Atlantic, so that's Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland. And one of the things you may or may not, because you're Californians and you're used to Kaiser, but there's long been a criticism, why can't Kaiser spread outside of Oregon and California, where 85% of members have lived? And there's like every time they try to go to, call it Atlanta, call it Colorado, call it Mid-Atlantic, fail. And many of them have had to close. And Mid-Atlantic was on the verge of failing in the late 2000s, 2007 or so, taken over by Kaiser Northern California. Mm-hmm. They sent out a ear, nose, and throat surgeon named Bernadette Loftus and completely transformed the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very methodical. Scheduling's got to be better. You're dealing with, you know, high-income, high-educated Washingtonians. They expect to see a doctor. So change the scheduling. Change the contracts. Don't send patients to every hospital. Work with hospitals that are very efficient. And not just that. Send Kaiser doctors to be in those hospitals. Don't rely on local doctors unless you have to. And over the last 8 years or 10 years now, membership has skyrocketed. Their five-star ranking in Medicare, they're one of the top 13 health systems going in the country. So they've, like, total 180-degree change, and they're one of the best-performing groups in the country. And so, when people ask me, where do I get insurance in Washington, D.C., I said, I would go there unless you have a really good reason not to.
It seems odd that an organization that's so successful, like Northern California, has to wait until a practice is failing to go in and say, oh, no, here's how you do it.
So, first of all, it wasn't that Northern California waited. You needed, the way the Kaiser is structured, you needed Mid-Atlantic to ask Northern California to come in. Okay. The second thing I would say is it's very, very interesting. So for many years, I think Kaiser was trying to take the entire Kaiser structure and move it. And that actually is, I think, one thing that didn't work. Whereas there were lots of Kaiser practices, these transformational practices, and those are what needed to be moved. And that actually, so when I studied this and said, you know, it's these practices. It's not the superstructure or the financial arrangements and all of that. Yeah. It gave me a lot of heart because it meant that you could take the Kaiser practices and move them outside of Kaiser. You could take the Kaiser practices. You're never going to get Kaiser in South Dakota. You're just not. But you could take the practices that have made Kaiser successful and put them in South Dakota. So you could spread these practices, whereas you can't spread the superstructure of a Kaiser with owning the hospitals, the insurance companies, and all necessarily to the whole country. Yeah. So that actually makes me very optimistic that once you can actually revive a place like Mid-Atlantic by adopting the right practices, that can happen throughout the country. And that's really part of the main motivation of the book, is if to show physicians and others, and including the public, that these are the elements of success that can actually make our system really top performing.
And the other thing you write about, speaking of insurance, which I believe we're supposed to kiss goodbye before too long. We'll get to that in a minute. But paying based on outcomes rather than procedures.
Right, right.
Is that happening more in... I know under the Affordable Care Act, it was supposed to happen more, and I'm not sure whether it has. And outside of it, I'm not sure it happens
so
at all.
Let me make a general point, which is, these change in practices at the coalface, where the doctor, patient, the nurse practitioner, patient, hospital, and patient meet, so that people are emphasizing high quality, emphasizing being cost conscious, where there are choices, Those only happen if we change the incentive for doctors and hospitals. Sometimes that happens because you have a really charismatic person. They just want to do the right thing, and they, you know, don't give a damn about the amount of money. But that's rare. So you need to have a change of incentives. Now, when I worked in the White House, I was one of the people really pushing. We needed more change in financial incentives in the Affordable Care Act. And as I describe in my previous book, Reinventing American Healthcare, I lost a lot of those battles. So just to give you one example, I don't know how many of you are familiar with bundled payment, but bundled payment is different from what we do generally now. Generally, we pay separately for each item. So, for example, if you're getting a hip replacement, you pay for the hospital and the operating room. Separately, you pay for the orthopedist. Separately, you pay for the anesthesiologist. Separately, you pay for the rehab person. And everything has its separate billing. It's like buying a car piece by piece and then assembling it. You know, bundle payment is we pay one thing and we get the whole shebang, and then you doctor, you hospital, you rehab, you work together and figure out how to do it efficiently. Here's the price. So I was like a big advocate for bundle payment, primarily because it targets surgeons, orthopedists, cabbages. Also, it can target specialists like myself, oncologists, cardiologists putting stents in, and it's a good way not just to work with changing the primary care doctor, but changing the high-cost specialists and surgeons. Well, I lost that. All the Affordable Care Act is we'll do five experiments over the next 5 years. No guarantee they'll be implemented. Fortunately, we had some other arrangements in the bill that drove some of these big experiments, important experiments in payment reform. In addition, the last Secretary of Health and Human Services under President Obama pledged that half of all Medicare payment would be alternative payment models like bundle payment, like capitation, by 2018. And so Medicare is pushing this payment reform. Simultaneously, or a little behind, private insurers have also been pushing it. And finally, MACRA, another bill that was passed in 2015, is also pushing and incentivizing doctors to switch to these alternative payment models. Now, that was the good news. The not-so-good news is that Secretary Price, Secretary of Health and Human Services, has rolled some of this back or diluted it, unfortunately. And I think, you know, he is a physician who loves the fee-for-service model, thinks, you know, fee-for-service at least keeps government and payers out of my business, but it doesn't actually lead to the best patient care. I really think we could go much faster. I think the system and doctors and hospitals are ready to go much faster, and I'll just give you one data point on that. For several years after I left the administration, I worked hard on creating a bundle payment for cancer because I thought cancer was a great model. You know, say you unfortunately get breast cancer and then you need radiation therapy and you use 6 months of chemotherapy or 4 months of chemotherapy, right? It's a unit. We can price the unit. We know what it should be. And you would incentivize oncologists to reduce emergency room use, make sure patients aren't hospitalized, incentivize them to actually give what are called preferred chemotherapy regimens, the regimens that have been proven to be the best for patients. And so I will tell you, Medicare was very resistant to adopting this idea. We worked for 2 years with them, and we put it into place, and then they announced it. And, you know, a huge swath of the American oncology community loved the idea and actually signed on. And I think, the oncologists are very ready to, you know, we don't want to make our money by just prescribing drugs. We actually want to manage patients better, really focus on the quality of care, and focus on where we have choices, being efficient. So that makes me optimistic that the system is ready. We need the payers, Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurers to move.
He's optimistic about our healthcare system.
I am very optimistic about the American healthcare system, and I'll tell you why. I love to say this in California. I am wildly optimistic because of California wines. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I see a puzzled look out there. Like, what the hell does California wines have to do? So I will take you, and this is a relatively young group, so you may not remember it, but I will tell you, and then you can go look up all the details in Wikipedia about the, I think it's called the Challenge of Paris. So in 1976, a London wine merchant decided he was going to do a blind taste testing comparing California wines and French wines. Now, for a kid like me, you know, this was like heresy, because I grew up in the era when, you know, California wine was Gallo jug wine, right? And it's like the idea that to compete with, you know, Rothschild, Latour, whatever, is like absurd. But he had blind taste testing in Paris with French judges, right? And Stag's Leap won the red wine part, and you can imagine how the French took this quite calmly and soberly. And, right? I mean, it's rigged, you know. They found every excuse under the sun. But what it says, I think, is actually a profound truth about America, which is we're the most innovative, entrepreneurial, hard-driving people on the planet. And when we put our mind to something, we can be the best in the world, unquestionably. Now, since 76 and when we did it in wine, we've done it in a whole series of areas, right? I mean, I forget who it was. Was it Craig Claiborne or someone said, you know, what did America give to cooking but the tin can? You know, the fact is, you know, among the world's best cooking is now in the United States. We have, you know, we're knocking it out on craft beers. I've actually just made a chocolate that is going to go on sale in a month. You know, we are doing it in chocolate. Just quiet promo there.
We all want a prescription.
It's, you know, we can do it when we put our mind to it, and we really have tremendously innovative people. The problem in healthcare has been that the incentive structure, the organizations have been not unleashing entrepreneurial spirit and the innovation, and payment change is critical to unleashing that. And what you've seen over the last 6 or 7 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act is a huge 32% increase in venture capital in healthcare, not in drugs, but in changing how healthcare is delivered. You've seen a lot of innovation going on out there. There's a lot of people in the Silicon Valley investing heavily in transformation. And a lot of it's happening in places that were, you know, not looked at before. Primary care, mental health care, palliative care, the backwaters of healthcare are now becoming areas where people are really focused on to try to, we know we can do much, much better in those particular areas. And that's another reason giving me optimism. You know, if Silicon Valley and the smart venture capitalists are investing in this, there's got to be something there other than my stupid opinion. So,
well, we all know that you helped to write the Affordable Care Act. We may not all know that you've been chatting with Donald Trump on how to reform it.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I forget exactly exactly the date, but it was sometime in late November. I got a call. I happened to be on an Amtrak train, and I took the call from the president-elect, and he said that, you know, he was going to do healthcare reform, and he wanted to talk to me, and you know, maybe sometime in mid-January when we're getting ready, I ought to come down to the New York or Washington and talk to him. And it was like, I'm a believer that, you know, we've got to do this bipartisan. I'm a believer that some the things he said, he wanted to provide coverage to everyone. He didn't want to cut everyone off. He wanted to regulate drug prices, were things he believed in, and we would push forward. And I said to him, actually, you know, I don't think we should wait to mid-January because, you know, the Republican Congress is going to come in. They might, before you are even inaugurated, pass something like repeal and no replace, and that'll completely tie your hands. You'll be backed into a corner, and it'll be a disaster for you out of the box. And he said, okay, why don't you come in? And I think he gave me a date in mid-December, like 10 days from then. And so I went down to Trump Tower and met with him for an hour to talk about not doing repeal and replace, but not doing repeal without a replacement, but why you had to do repeal and replace if that's the way you were going to go. And I told them that I thought there was a lot of room for bipartisanship on this issue because, you know, most Democrats thought, you know, the ACA was good but not perfect. It needed some fixing, that there was a lot more we could do on payment change to bring costs down, and everyone was talking about affordability, and he himself had been committed to drug cost change, and that we should focus in, and again, there was bipartisan agreement on drug costs because Democrats wanted that too. And then I met with him subsequently in February and in March, just before the House Republicans were to vote. It was a very large meeting in March with Paul Ryan was there, Secretary Price, Vice President Pence, the head of Office of Management and Budget, Mel Vaney, and about 10 advisors were in the room. So we were debating the House's approach, and I said why I thought it was a disaster. I think the president would confirm that I was not shy.
Yeah, I assume that you would think everything they've tried was a disaster, and even the president, after the first try, later said it was mean.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
What do you think is the dynamic there? Did he just not make any progress, or did he not try to persuade Congress to do something more humane?
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not privy to the day-to-day operations. I would say it's become quite clear that hardcore people who want to, their main motivation seems to be two things, as far as I can tell, and here I'm speaking outside without any inside knowledge here. They just want to pass something, whatever it is, to say that they've satisfied their base. We all know from reading the papers that their big, big donors want them to repeal the ACA, and that has been a major motivation for, you know, reviving the repeal of it in the guise of Cassidy Graham. And the second thing I would say is I think they are very sincere about wanting to end an entitlement like Medicaid, and I think they really, really want to just end that as an entitlement, and I think that is a very big ideological commitment that someone like Paul Ryan has made, and that was the cornerstone of their proposal, and I think that thinking is probably pervasive in the White House, separate from the president. I don't think it's something he shares, from what I could tell. But I do think people like Mulvaney and Pence share that with Ryan, and I think that's been the sort of driving force of this. Yeah. Just pass something, and by the way, if we're going to pass something, it ought to end an entitlement. So.
A number of good questions on Medicaid, all or most of them around the idea of how do you get across the fact that this isn't just an entitlement for lazy people, for poor people
really?
Who don't. I mean, 60% of Medicaid recipients, I believe, nationwide work at some level. How do you approach that? How do you make that?
So you make an incredibly important point, which is the notion that, and here I'll use a politically incorrect term to quote Ronald Reagan, that what we're doing is giving a lot of money to welfare queens through Medicaid is just bunk. First of all, the image of welfare queens is wrong. And second of all, that's not what the situation is on Medicaid. So in the old Medicaid, pre-ACA, right, there were four main groups of people who got assistance on Medicaid. Children, right, who did nothing wrong and are not financially responsible for themselves, right? largely pregnant women and parents of those children, the disabled, and the elderly who are poor and need help paying for Medicare's coinsurance and other items. And by the way, the disabled and the elderly combined are about, don't have the statistics exactly off my head, but a third of all Medicaid recipients, but about 50% of all Medicaid dollars, maybe even a quarter of Medicaid recipients. So much less of the money is going to children and pregnant women than the numbers. And you're 100% right, which is two-thirds of the people who are on Medicaid are either working or they're in families where there's a primary breadwinner. The problem is they're working at jobs where they don't get health insurance through the job, and they're paid too little. They're paid minimum wage or just barely above, that they can't buy insurance on their own. They're not scofflaws. They're not simply lazy people wanting a government handout. Many of them are working two and three jobs in the household to pay the bills. The problem is they're working, whether it's retail, fast food, or whatever, where they can't get health insurance. As you well know, many people work for Walmart or McDonald's, and retail is, this is particularly common, just there's not enough on the income and the wages to justify a fringe benefit that's worth, $15,000. That's the problem. Now, what did the Medicare, what did the ACA do? It said, listen, we are not going to say it's only certain categories. The biggest category left out of traditional Medicaid were working adults who didn't have kids, right? And so basically the transformation is, look, if you fall below 138% of the federal poverty line, you're eligible for Medicaid, period, end of story. You don't have to be in one of these special categories of the deserving poor who happens to be disabled, or the deserving poor who happens to be a pregnant woman. That makes no sense. We should just cover everyone in the system. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's what a humane society does. Interestingly, and again, I'll fess up, I have not been a big fan of Medicaid. Lots of doctors don't take it because the payment is too low.
Right.
It doesn't do a great job of coordinating care. It's very difficult to get specialists to take Medicaid. There are a number of problems. Nonetheless, if you look at the people who've gotten Medicaid through the expansion, they are wildly happy with it. Why is that? Well, it does cover primary care doctors. It does get you tests, and it has very, very low copays. No deductibles, low copays. In some sense, it's what not to like. Yes, I can't go to a super specialist at, Stanford Hospital, but that doesn't mean I don't get good primary care, I don't get my preventative tests, I don't go bankrupt, and I don't have to shell out a lot of dough. So it works for a segment of our population, especially since they haven't had anything before that covered these kinds of services. And so we should learn from why people are happy with this, which many, many people look down their nose on.
A couple of folks have asked about your ideas to strengthen this and sustain the ACA. If the bipartisan committee in the Senate had gotten anywhere, what should they have done?
Well, so many of you may know that there had been a move by Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, who's the chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the HELP Committee, with his Patty Murray, who's a senator, Democratic senator from Washington, to try to put together a bill that would help stabilize the insurance marketplaces. That was put on ice and chilled while the Republicans were pushing through Graham Cassidy. Now with, Graham Cassidy dead, my prediction is that Alexander Murray will be revived. And so the political calculation is the following. Well, things go bad in the exchanges. Premiums are high. Lots more counties are bare with no insurer. You can't blame Obama. Right? This is a Trump problem. This is a price problem. This is a Republican problem. This is the first full year that they have had control over the exchanges, and it's going to come around their neck, and going into 2018 elections, it could look ugly. So I think you're going to get an agreement. I think the big question is that agreement a sort of skinny, narrow agreement, or is it going to be a wider, bigger, better agreement? So if you talk to health policy experts, and again, I don't care whether you're talking to conservatives or liberals, almost all of us agree on a set of reforms that go something like this. Clearly, one thing you need to do is to guarantee the cost-sharing subsidies. These are subsidies that insurance companies are supposed to pay to poor people, people under 250% of the poverty line, to help them pay for deductibles and co-pays and co-insurance and things like that. Insurance companies are on the hook for them, even if the federal government doesn't pay them. So what do they do if they're on the hook and the federal government won't pay them? Jack up rates. You got to jack up those premiums. So we have seen a 5 to 10% increase in premiums because of uncertainty about the cost-sharing subsidies. Second, reinsurance. So you're in a new marketplace. You don't know who's going to come in and buy insurance, how many people are going to come in and buy insurance. You don't know if you're going to get a bad risk pool, that is, a lot of people with a lot of illness, as has been the case. You don't know what your clients are going to look like. And this, by the way, is a chronic problem because right here in California, covered California, about a third of the people every year are new to the exchange. So you have no history with them. You don't know how to actuarially price things. So we put in the Affordable Care Act risk corridors and reinsurance to protect the insurance companies from getting a disproportionate number of sick people. It actually doesn't quite pay for itself, but pretty close to pays for itself because you provide reinsurance from the federal government and help to the insurance companies, and it turns out, again, it lowers the premium, so the amount of subsidies the government's paying out actually is lower. So it has this very positive effect. It doesn't quite balance that it's about $4 billion a year you need to pay, but it does keep premiums, again, down 5 to 10%. So if you guarantee the cost-sharing subsidies, provide reinsurance, you can bring premiums down between 10 and 20%. Good thing. What do you do about the, quote, bear counties, either counties with no insurance companies or just one insurance company and no competition? Well, there are a number of things you could do, change how they bid for counties. But you could also say, look, an insurance company that goes into a bear county or a county with only one insurance company, we're going to that tax that was in the ACA on insurance companies, for that state, we're not going to levy it on you, okay? So it provides a financial incentive for insurers to go into these less covered states. Third or fourth thing that we could do is vigorously enforce the mandate. The mandate is the law of the land. The Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land, right? Mm-hmm. Is now it Republicans saying, we're not going to enforce the law? That seems like a contradiction for the Law and Order Party, and not a good one. It seems to me if it's the law of the land, you need to enforce it, and you need to tell people, and you need to be vigorous about enforcing it. And we know that people do respond to that mandate. Not everyone. We still have a lot of people who should be getting insurance aren't. The fifth thing I would say, and I can say this right here in the heart of Silicon Valley and the tech industry, is, look, Google, Facebook, Amazon, they know your income, they know whether you have health insurance, and they know where you live, right?
It's true.
They can target an ad to you very, very well, yeah, saying you can get insurance for X amount of money, or we think you can get insurance for X amount of money, where that premium reflects what the subsidy you would get given your income. Targeted ads to call it, you know, 19 to 40 or 45 would be a very effective mechanism to get people who are, mm-hmm, for whatever reason, not buying insurance and induce them to buy insurance and give them at the real price during the open enrollment period. So there's five ideas that I think would dramatically alter the exchanges and put them on a very, very good course. Are there many other things I'd love to do? Absolutely. But let's begin with those. So I'd love to see the Alexander bill or the Alexander Murray bill go in that direction, and keep your eye on how big, how expansive it is, or is it just narrowly tailored to the cost-sharing subsidies?
Well, many of us right now have our eyes on Bernie Sanders and all of the people piling on with him to do Medicare for all, single payer.
I get in trouble every time I come to California on this issue.
He didn't win the primary here. He was a Hillary country.
So let me make, I don't know, a number of points. First, let's begin with history. I'm a big history buff, and I think we need to keep our eye on the history because it can tell us a lot of things about what's possible in this country. We've been debating single payer in this country since 1912 election when Teddy Roosevelt put it out, and we've never passed anything close to a single payer. All right? That ought to tell you something. Second, the first single payer bill introduced in Congress was 1943, never passed. Third, let me recount a moment in history for you. This is 1973-74. It's a unique moment in American history. Those of you who are old enough or history aficionados like myself, you'll remember that Richard Nixon was in the White House. He had just won a huge electoral victory. Teddy Kennedy was the healthcare leader in the Senate for the Democrats, and the Democrats controlled the majority of the Senate. And Wilbur Mills was head of the House Ways and Means Committee. The House Ways and Means Committee is the committee in the House that controls healthcare reform and single payer. And Wilbur Mills had seen the big success with Medicare and Medicaid and was now on board, which he wasn't in 1960, with getting a more comprehensive healthcare reform. You had a unique moment with all the big players agreeing on healthcare reform. And by the way, Richard Nixon, from the first day he was a congressman, was very, very big on universal coverage in this country. His big proposal was government giving subsidies to people based upon their income to buy private insurance. You ever heard of that plan before? he introduced it in 1947, okay? So you had people, and then the only issue is what is it going to look like? And then two big things happened. You probably remember one of them, Watergate. And you might not remember the other, Fannie Fox. That was an exotic Argentinian dancer who fell out of Wilbur Mills' car into the tidal basin.
Right.
Wilbur Mills had a big scratch across his face. You know, sex scandals and corruption, you know, it's Washington. That deal fell apart. But while this was all happening, Richard Nixon was very desperate to strike a deal, right? Watergate's coming up around him. He wants to show he's still relevant. He's really willing to strike a deal. He's not willing to go single payer, but the single payer advocates in the Democratic Party say, listen, he's on the ropes. The 1974 elections, midterm elections are coming up. We're going to win huge, and we're going to get our single payer. And you know, we're not compromising with this guy to get some private kind of universal coverage where people get subsidies to buy private insurance. We want our single-payer system. What happened? Democrats did win a huge victory in 1974 midterm election. Huge, right? They enormous control of the House, enormous control of the Senate. What happened to health care? Never got passed. Why didn't get passed? Vance overtook it. Watergate investigation, impeachment, blah, blah, blah. Be careful. Might look like you've got it in the hand, and it won't be there. Politically, let's start with the politics, and let me just make two points about the politics here. First point is, some of you may know that for a brief period of time, about 9 months, I guess, I was a Fox contributor. My brother transferred my contract from MSNBC to Fox. He says, I want the president to hear you. I went in on my first day to the offices in New York with the Fox News people, and one of the heads there took out a map, put the map down, put his hands over the coast, over California, over the East Coast, and he said, you see that? All red. Those are our viewers. Remember that.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's Chicago there. There was Houston there. But the rest of it was pretty red. It's hard to pass single payer in America, given the way we structure government and the fact that between the coasts, there are a lot of senators who get elected. Second, single payer at least as currently conceived by Sanders and the Sanders bill, eliminates insurance companies. Now, you're the CEO of a random insurance company. What's your reaction to that? Oh, yeah, we're just going out of business. We're going home. Or is your reaction, oh, this is an existential threat to me. I'm, you know, fighting this with everything I have. You might recall that in 1993, the Clintons had a similar idea of getting rid of the insurance companies and going to cooperatives and yada, yada. You might not remember until I remind you that the insurance industry ran something called the Harry and Louise ads.
Oh, yes.
And if, yeah, yes. Oh, yeah, now I remember.
Harry and Louise, yep.
And if you don't remember, you might want to go to YouTube and look at some of those ads. They're a little horrifying, to be honest. They actually make insurance companies look like warm, cuddly teddy bears, ironically enough. And they did persuade a lot of Americans that, you know, this whatever cooperative, maybe I like my insurance company as much as I hate them, better than the unknown. So politically, I think you're going to have a tough time. Nonetheless, I have moved myself, and I'll be perfectly honest, I'm not one of those people who, you know, I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, you know, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So I think if we're going to debate single payer in this country again, we ought to think about what would a responsible single-payer plan be. A responsible plan, by which I mean, you can't get rid of insurance companies, so how are you going to make peace with them? You're going to have cost control in there, because I think we need to have cost control. We just can't have an open checkbook. And you have to have big incentives to get high quality and not just pay regardless of quality. And the last thing I would say is, have to have a transition. You're not going from our current system to single payer overnight. What's a transition that the country can handle look like? So I've been thinking about this, and I think there are some ways you could design a responsible single payer proposal. There are a lot of challenges, and I think we should not underestimate the challenges. Let me just give you one that keeps me up at night. I had the privilege, a very old collaborator of mine is a man named Victor Fuchs. You may not have ever heard of him. He is actually one of the original three health economists in the world. He's 94 or something, lives in Palo Alto. He's a professor here at Stanford since the early 70s, one of the true geniuses of American healthcare economics and healthcare policy. And we were, you know, right before I came here, I was over at his house, and we were talking, and he said, you know, I think the biggest problem with the American healthcare system as compared to the Europeans is we have fragmented finance. We have all these private insurers. We have Medicaid, Medicaid, VA. And maybe, you know, see, the advantage of single payer is it unifies it. And I said, yes, that is a huge advantage. It's also a huge disadvantage, and this is what worries me and keeps me up at night, which is, let's say you're a doctor or Stanford Hospital, and all your money's coming from one payer. Right? Now that payer says, oh, I've got a new idea. I'm going to pay you in a different way. What's your reaction going to be? Hell no, you're not. Right? I've got business plans going out 10 and 15 years based upon that payment and anticipation, and you're going to change it? Invariably, you know, we all get nervous about change. I'm going to lose is your first reaction no matter what. It's going to, I think, make reform much, much harder. So the advantage, yes, you get one set of incentives. The disadvantage is maybe we end up with a lot more gridlock around reforms. It's a lot harder to do, even though it's hard in our current system to do. Because in our current system, all right, Medicare is going to pay me differently. 60% of my payments come from others. That's pretty stable. I know what they're doing. And, you know, I'm willing to try some of this newfangled stuff. So I think flexibility and the ability to try new things is probably going to be greater under this than a single-payer system. And the last thing I would say, the very last thing I would say about single-payer is you're going to have one organization that's going to manage $3.5 trillion for 326 million people. Anyone know that organization that runs efficiently without corruption and can really do that? It's a big, big, big task. And I don't think we should underestimate the administrative logistical tasks. Yes, there are many people who are super talented in America and can run a corporation with a million workers. It's very different running anything as complex as healthcare for 326 million people. And so all of those reasons make me nervous. But as I've said, I've moved a little and said, well, I can begin to imagine something that might have the right characteristics for a progressive system that doesn't kill the insurance company, so it doesn't kill the political chances, et cetera, et cetera.
Is anyone, I was personally surprised how many Democrats just jumped on that. Do you know if anyone is out there looking at, anyone political is out there looking at that middle way?
Well, I think I like to remind people that Medicare was passed in 1965. The discussion of Medicare began in 1957 with the first bill introduced called Medicare. It was an eight-year process. We're not passing single payer next year. I can guarantee that. We're not passing it before 2021 at the earliest. There's a long time to debate this, and so I think it might be we're just at the earliest processes.
Okay. How does Medicare work as a payment system? I mean, what are does it?
Well,
does it now present better incentives?
You know, if you ask doctors and hospitals, there are things they like about it, right? They know what the fee is, so there's, like, clear knowledge. It pays rapidly. They're not waiting. There are no prior authorizations, so the headache of, you know, I want to get this MRI, but I got to talk to the insurance company, blah, blah, blah. All of that's nice. On the flip side is it's under-administered, and so lots of things it should do to, say, improve the pricing, what things are worth. It can't do because it doesn't have enough people, personnel, or money to do it. There's a high level of fraud. Exactly how much is hotly contested and open to debate, but we can assume really high levels of fraud. And we know that they're concentrated in particular states. And did I mention Florida? And so there are some serious problems with it. It's also not structured in a modern way. You know, the hospital portion is different than the doctor portion, paid for in different ways, different deductibles. So there would have to be some modernizing of Medicare. Nonetheless, we also have to admit, you know, seniors love it. And, you know, so there are advantages.
I think we are getting pretty close to the time for our last question. And I'm going to ask, this is something I asked earlier before the show, but a number of people have mentioned this. What can we do as patients to help reform the healthcare system? In your book, you talk about how people should look for doctors, what they should look for. It's not quite the same thing as saying, how can you bring about change?
There are two elements to this question. One is, what can I individually do about my own healthcare and my family's healthcare and stuff? And I do think that has a big signaling effect on the healthcare system. If a large number of people begin to ask for certain things, the system notices. It's not a perfect way of communication and showing your... I'll just tell you this story. My middle daughter was in Washington working for NPR and decided she's going to get move up to Boston and then, you know, 6 months later, in anticipation of getting married, and move to the NPR station, one of the NPR stations in Boston. And when she moved to Boston, she, you know, calls up her father and says, I need a doctor in Boston. Can you get me a doctor in Boston? I'm like, what the hell? I haven't practiced in Boston in, you know, decades. So what did I do? Well, I probably did what you did. I called up a friend who was in Boston and said, who's a good primary care doctor, right? Here I am, you know, as knowledgeable about the healthcare system as anyone in the country, and I'm like doing the old, same old, same old. And so it occurred to me, you know, and this is happening simultaneously with me writing the book, it occurred to me, all right, if I were to tell my daughter or whoever asked me, can you get me a good doctor in said city, what have I learned from this process of going around to see the best that would be the questions to ask of a doctor's office that would signal they're really doing good stuff? So one is this open access scheduling, as I mentioned to you. Do you do open access scheduling so I can come in when I need to see the doctor? And it seems to me one of the important things that open access scheduling communicates to me as a patient is, you know, You're focused on me as a patient. You're not organizing your time around the doctor. You're organizing your time around me. And that's, I think, an important thing because it's not just the scheduling. It will affect everything else that they do. The second thing, I think, is I want a doctor who is looking at their performance, how well they're doing, and trying to improve. Well, how can I find that out? There are a variety of ways, but one that I like is NCQA, which is an organization in Washington committed to quality, has created this patient-centered medical home program for primary care doctors. And part of that program is monitoring your performance against standard metrics and developing improvement plans for practices. Is it the best? I don't know. Is it good? Yes. Are there others? Yes. Specialties have their own kind of equivalents. So I would say, ask, do you have open access scheduling? And ask, are you participating as a practice in a performance improvement plan? Like, are you a patient-centered medical home? Are you engaged in some similar kind of program? Those are the, I like to say, two basic questions. And if what you're looking for, you're, you know, like some of these nice 30-year-olds in the audience, and you're looking for a primary care doc and you don't have any serious health problems, that's probably all you need to ask. For some of others of us who might have chronic conditions, or we're trying to search for a doctor for our parents, or God forbid, you know, we have a relative who has cancer and want to advise them, there are other questions to ask. So if you've got someone who's got cancer, you might want to ask, do you have a palliative care service with you? If you've got someone who's got chronic conditions and that's really dominating, they've got diabetes or heart disease or hypertension or asthma, you might want to ask, do you have chronic care coordinators that are co-located in your office? If you've got someone who has, you know, mild mental health problems like anxiety disorders or depression or some alcohol abuse, you might want to ask, are you co-located with behavioral health care specialists, or do you have an affiliation with a set of behavioral health care providers? And I can go, you know, the book does this. It gives you other questions to ask for particular kinds of situations. And I think that's really important because if doctors are beginning to say, you know, there are smart patients out there, they're asking if I'm a patient-centered medical home, maybe I ought to go be a patient-centered medical home, or they're asking to have open access scheduling, I haven't done it yet, maybe I ought to do that. I think that is actually some demand pull that will actually drive the system a little bit. How to become politically involved in healthcare reform. So one of the things, or the two places I focus is, one, your employer. There is a contradiction in American business, which is, healthcare costs are killing me, they're killing me. And then they do, big business does nothing about it except that they raise your deductibles to lower their premiums. They don't actually go to Washington or think, okay, how can we redesign our health insurance program to be better? And when they go to Washington, they do all the other stuff, but they don't really focus on healthcare, or they, in other ways, communicate to politicians while they're out in the public saying that healthcare costs are killing them. They really don't mean it in terms of, we're actually going to try to push something. You can go to your employer, and, or if you are the CEO of a company or the CFO or some big muckety-muck at a company, and say, look, we're going to do things that are going to actually make a difference. We're going to require our carrier or our insurer to actually pay doctors, not fee-for-service, but switch over to paying them these alternative payments like bundled payments. We're going to require every one of our workers have a primary care doctor, and that the primary care doctor recognize and get performance data to those primary care doctors on how they're treating our patients. You can ask for different contracting, like, you know, reference pricing. Reference pricing is, we're going to pay this amount for a colonoscopy. You want it more expensive. So do that. And then don't underestimate how powerful you are when you write letters or call your congressman or senator about particular things like Graham Cassidy. You are the ruling elite in America, and they listen to you. They don't just count how many people, they also count who those people are. And you should make your voice known. On that note.
On that note, thank you so much, Doctor. I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. We'd like to thank Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, author of Prescription for the Future, the 12 Transformational Practices of Highly Effective Medical Organizations, and to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of us joining you, joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you very much.